Well, in our Sunday evenings just now then, we're looking at Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6. Last Sunday evening we considered the first half of that verse, for to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And this evening then we're going to consider the next little bit of the verse, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. And I suppose that at the outset we ought to comment on the apparent inaccuracy here. This verse is clearly a messianic prophecy. Isaiah, like other prophets, primarily addressed his contemporary situation, exposing the idolatry and corruption and hypocrisy amongst God's people in his own day. But again, like other prophets, he also did more than that. He also looked beyond his contemporary situation to a whole new phase of God's redemptive action, centering upon a saviour figure, the servant of the Lord, the anointed one, the root of Jesse. This massive book is punctuated with messianic prophecies. And as modern readers of Isaiah, living AD rather than BC, possessing the New Testament as well as the Old Testament, we are sometimes staggered by how much Isaiah knew. The fact that the Messiah would be born of a virgin. The fact that he would be a light for the Gentiles. The fact that he would suffer in a substitutionary way. Even the fact that he will be buried in a rich man's tomb. Isaiah's detailed insight into these things seems at some points amazing. At other points, however, it seems less so. And particularly when Isaiah talks about names, according to chapter 7, verse 14. The virgin mother would call her son Emmanuel, God with us. And according to our text here in chapter 9, he would be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now you can trawl through the four New Testament Gospels verse by verse, and you will never find Jesus being called these things. He's called many things. Jesus, Son of David, Master, Lord, and so on. But no disciple, no inquirer, no cowering demon, no one ever calls him Emmanuel or Wonderful Counselor or any of the other names which Isaiah said he would be called. And I'm asking then, why is that? How do we deal with the prophet's apparent inaccuracy? Well, one answer is that this is a phrase, it's a saying. When Isaiah wrote, he will be called, ... he didn't mean that people would literally actually refer to the Messiah in these exact terms. He simply meant, this is what he'll be. He'll be Emmanuel, God with us. He'll be Wonderful Counselor, and so on. That's the role he'll fulfill. That's the identity he'll have. It's simply a phrase which would have made sense in the culture in which Isaiah was writing. That's one answer, and I think it's a correct answer insofar as it goes. But perhaps it's also true that there's something a bit deeper going on here. Remember David, and remember how in 2 Samuel 7, verses 12 to 14, David is given a promise, isn't he? I will raise up your offspring to succeed you. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. David's offspring, in other words, was going to be someone very special, with a special kingdom and a special relationship to God. And as you read on, and eventually David's son Solomon ascends to the throne of Israel, you assume that this is the one. You assume that this is the promised offspring. And especially when Solomon possesses, along with the name Solomon, another God-given name, Jedidiah, loved by the Lord. You can read all about it in 2 Samuel 12:25. And this was highly unusual. God didn't normally go around conferring his own names, overriding the parents' names and conferring his own names on people. It looked like divine confirmation. This is the one. This is the special king. This is the fulfillment of the promise. But of course, as you read on further, after an encouraging start, Solomon proves a major disappointment and is succeeded by king after king after king, most of whom are even more disappointing still. And the promise then of 2 Samuel 7 seems to have failed, until we come to Isaiah chapter 9 and this prophecy of a king who, verse 7, will reign on David's throne, and a king who significantly possesses a God-given name, an even better one than Jedidiah. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. It's God declaring, this is the one. Solomon was a type. Solomon was a faint foreshadowing. Solomon was a flawed miniature. This is the special king. This is the fulfillment of the 2 Samuel 7 promise. And so, as I say, I think it is an idiom that Isaiah is using. He will be called. It's a phrase, but I think also perhaps something deeper is going on. Isaiah is saying he's going to have a God-given name. Doesn't that remind you of someone? This is David's offspring, David's greater son, who will be given that everlasting kingdom. Well, having commented then on that formula, he will be called, let's begin to look this evening at exactly what he would be called. What was his God-given name to be? And so we're going to look then at two parts of that this evening. So first of all, Wonderful Counselor. Wonderful Counselor. And I'd like to just mention three things in connection with this first part of the name. First of all, its basic meaning. Its basic meaning. Now, the role of counselor was a very familiar one in the ancient world. When you watch the news and you see David Cameron one minute fighting his corner at Prime Minister's Question Time, the next minute debating with European leaders about the financial crisis, that you mustn't think that complex politics like this is a peculiarly modern phenomenon. No, when you read the Old Testament, you see there, don't you, that the politics of the ancient Near East were pretty complex. You see in the pages of the Old Testament a bewildering variety of alliances between different states at different times. You see ambitious state officials, don't you, who carry a threat of sedition for the kings of their countries. You see all kinds of intrigue and manipulation and different political games going on in the Old Testament. Clearly, politics were pretty complex then as well. And in that context then, kings needed counselors. They needed to be fed a constant stream of wise advice so that they would make good political decisions. And so they had counselors. King David, for instance. I mean, he doesn't strike you as one of the more incompetent or naive rulers in the pages of the Old Testament. He was a pretty able chap, but even he had a counselor. Ahithophel, of course, was David's counselor, most famous for deserting David and going over to Absalom's side. You remember how David then prayed that his counsel would be turned to foolishness, and God answered that prayer. But David then had a counselor. We're told of many situations where David inquired of the Lord, should I do this or should I not? But clearly there were many other situations where David was contemplating a military campaign or a reorganization of his palace staff or a foreign trade deal. And in those instances, he called upon Ahithophel and they would have a meeting and they would discuss things. And Ahithophel then would give his wise and shrewd and sane advice to David. So that's what a counselor was in the ancient world. It was someone who dispensed wise advice for the benefit, usually, of a ruler. And as for wonderful, well, we tend to use the word wonderful just as a fairly vague and general adjective, don't we? Meaning great, good, fantastic. But in the Bible, in the Old Testament, the word is more specific than that. It has the connotation of supernatural. And so wonderful counselor here is supernatural counselor. One dispensing counsel by some kind of supernatural power, with some kind of supernatural acumen. That's the idea here. So that's its basic meaning. But then secondly, its primary focus. Its primary focus, because bear in mind how I've just defined a counselor then, it may seem a rather odd description to use of Jesus. I mean, we're accustomed to thinking of Jesus as a prophet, or Jesus as a priest, or Jesus as a king. But Jesus as a counselor. I mean, the counselor, it was an important role, but it was a fairly unglamorous role. It was this background kind of role. We think of Jesus as the great David, the great Moses, the great Aaron, but Jesus is the great Ahithophel. It just doesn't have the same kind of ring. It seems a little strange. Why is Jesus being described as a counselor? Well, I think probably the primary focus here, when he's described as a counselor, isn't on the actual execution of this role. It's rather on the main qualification for this role. What was the main qualification to be a counselor? What was the main qualification that propelled Ahithophel, no doubt, into his position? It was wisdom. To be a counselor, you had to be wise. Wisdom was the great qualification for the role. And that's the primary focus here, I think, as Jesus is described as a counselor. Not that he'll actually perform the duties of an Ahithophel, but that he will be characterized by wisdom. That's the great point. Now, what is wisdom? It's a word we use reasonably often, but what do we actually mean by it? Is wisdom the same as cleverness? Smartness? Well, it isn't, is it? Cleverness is about mere academic ability, being able to pass exams. It's an intellectual academic concept. That's what cleverness is. Wisdom, on the other hand, is nothing to do with academic ability. It's utterly unrelated, in fact, to academic ability. Wisdom is making sound choices. That's what wisdom in biblical terms is. It's making good and sound choices. And of course, Jesus had to do that during his life on earth on a daily basis. Jesus, because of the mission that he was on, had to make sound choices. Let me just give you one example. It's almost an arbitrary example. There are so many places we could go to, but I suppose it is a particularly striking one. It's Matthew chapter 4, Jesus being tempted by the devil. And you remember how the devil directs various temptations at him. But I'm particularly thinking of the last of the three there in Matthew 4. And it's in verse 8 where we read that the devil took him, that's Jesus, to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give you, he said, if you bow down and worship me. And of course that was it might seem to us from our vantage point this evening a pretty crass kind of temptation that the devil was directing at him. But actually it was a very subtle temptation. Because of course Jesus had been promised, as the Messiah, he had been promised all the kingdoms of the world. The devil is kind of picking up vaguely the language of Psalm 2, isn't he? And the Messiah being given the nations as his inheritance. This was precisely what God had promised to Jesus. I will give you the kingdoms of the world. But of course, Jesus had to secure that inheritance through suffering. He had to secure the nations of the world. He had to gain his inheritance by way of the cross. And what Satan is promising here is, I will give you it just by bowing down to me. A much easier route. Forget going to Calvary. Forget having to suffer on that dreadful cross. Just do this little thing, this easy thing. Just bow down to me now. In 2 minutes' time, you can have the nations of the world. It's so easy. You can shortcut your mission. That was the subtlety. And it must have been an alluring temptation. Jesus, awed, daunted, intimidated by the enormity of his mission. It's an early point in his ministry, this, but no doubt already the concept of the cross is really beginning to preoccupy him. And how tempting. It's this easy way out. I can get the nations of the world by just bowing down to Satan in a moment. But of course it would have been disastrous. It would have been to have disobeyed his father. It would have been to have completely jeopardized his mission. It would have meant no salvation for you and for me. It would have meant absolute, unmitigated disaster. He had to make a sound choice in that moment. He had to exercise wisdom. And he did. And he responded so emphatically, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only." And Jesus then was wise. It was a dominating, a predominant characteristic of his life on earth. And his wisdom was wonderful. It was supernatural. It was a wisdom which wasn't merely human. It wasn't merely something he'd inherited from Mary and from his mother's gene pool. It was a supernatural wisdom. We're told that quite explicitly, actually, in this prophecy of Isaiah, just a couple of chapters further on, in chapter 11. We read there in the first two verses, "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse." This is talking about the Messiah again. "From his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. The Spirit of wisdom and of understanding. The Spirit of counsel and of power. The Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord." It was by the Holy Spirit that Jesus was so wonderfully and consistently wise. This was a supernatural wisdom. So its basic meaning, its primary focus. But then, thirdly, its additional suggestion. Because, yes, okay, the primary focus here is, I think, upon the qualification for being a counsellor. You had to be wise to be a counsellor. You had to be wise to get to Ahithophel's position. And Jesus was wise. But perhaps there is also a faint suggestion here that Jesus would be also the source of wisdom. The source of wisdom for others. See, we sang, didn't we, from Psalm 111 a moment ago. That refrain, which you find a number of times in the Old Testament, or it's slight variations on a theme. But that refrain, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." In other words, that refrain is saying that being wise isn't some kind of natural gift which is arbitrarily distributed across the human race. Some people are wise, other people aren't. It's just a natural gift. No, there may be a degree, a modicum of common sense, which is a kind of natural gift, but not wisdom. Not that ability to make sound choices. It's not possessed by anybody naturally. It's only, the Old Testament is saying, when you begin to fear God, that you can possibly begin to make sound choices. You can possibly begin to be wise. The gateway to wisdom is fearing God, knowing God, viewing the world through a God-centered pair of spectacles. And to put that another way, to change that refrain, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. In the light of the full biblical revelation, we could say the fear of Jesus is the beginning of wisdom. Knowing Christ is the beginning of wisdom. Being in relationship with Jesus is the gateway to wisdom. And that's an important thing for us all to consider tonight. If you're not a Christian tonight, and I don't say this blithely or disrespectfully, but in the Bible's assessment, you're a fool. And you may think that you're making good choices, but actually your choices are merely propelling you nearer and nearer to hell. Your choices are taking you to destruction. It's only through knowing Christ, it's only through coming to Him that you can possibly exercise wisdom. And in that sense then, Jesus is also a wonderful counselor. It's primarily talking about His character, but there is this additional suggestion that He is the source of wisdom for human beings in this world. So that's the first part then of Jesus' God-given name, Wonderful Counselor. But then, secondly this evening, Mighty God. Mighty God. And I think two things come out from this next part of the name. Jesus' identity and Jesus' role. First of all then, Jesus' identity. Namely that He is God. Jesus is God. Now, if no Bible verse anywhere explicitly called Him God, we would still have more than enough evidence in the Bible, more than enough data to arrive at that conclusion that He is God. We don't need those explicit ascriptions of deity to Jesus. It's part of the very fabric of the Bible. It's everywhere. You can even read the Jehovah's Witnesses' doctored scriptures and you'll still come to the deity of Christ because it's there everywhere. And even then, if there were no explicit indications of it, we would still have more than enough evidence. But of course there are. There are a number of verses which explicitly and unambiguously use the word God of Jesus Christ. And this then is one of them. Here the Messiah, here Jesus is called God. And we need to remind ourselves constantly, this is the heart of Christianity. If there's one doctrine that is the heart of Christianity, it's the deity of Jesus Christ. We can be confused on a whole lot of things as Christians. We can have muddled ideas on all kinds of biblical doctrines, but we must be clear on this. Christianity stands or falls with this, that Jesus is God. Jesus is God. You see, we began our service, didn't we, with Paul's great hymn there in Philippians 2. God has highly exalted Jesus. Why? That every knee to Him should bow, every tongue confess that He is Lord. That's why we and many others like us this Lord's Day, across the world, millions others like us, are gathering together in meetings, in services today. It's not to have a cup of tea together. It's not to chat over what we've been up to this past week. It's to worship Jesus Christ, to bow down to Him, and to confess His great and exalted status. But this is the point, you see. If Jesus isn't God, then that's blasphemous. If Jesus is just a great person, if He's just a semi-God, if He just has some divine bits and pieces in Him, then worshipping Jesus is blasphemous. Our whole religion is the most terrible blasphemy. But Jesus is God. The Bible is absolutely emphatic on this. And I'm saying then we need to be absolutely emphatic. What does it mean to be a Christian? More than anything, it means we worship Jesus Christ. That's why a Jehovah's Witness, however similar on some things they might see, can never ever possibly call them a Christian, because they're wrong on the fundamental issue. They're wrong on the one issue that matters, the deity of Jesus Christ. It's why it's wisest not to get caught up with peripheral issues when you're talking to them, because none of those peripheral issues really matter all that much. This is what matters. Is Jesus God? This is the heart of our religion. And this text then is taking us very directly to that point. And notice too, it's remarkable, isn't it? He will be called Mighty God. When will he be called Mighty God? He will be called Mighty God when he's been born a child. Unto us a child is born. He will be called Mighty God. That's remarkable, isn't it? It's not that Isaiah is saying now, as I write, in the 8th century BC, and the Son of God is still in his pre-incarnate state. Now he's the Mighty God. No, Isaiah is saying, even then, even once he's been born as a child, even once he's bearing weak human nature, he will still be the Mighty God. That's astonishing. In Bethlehem's manger, crying, and helpless, and pitiful, unable to speak, unable to do anything but flap his arms around pathetically, he will be the Mighty God. Working away on pieces of furniture in that Nazarene carpenter's workshop, he will be the Mighty God. As he weeps at Lazarus' graveside, he will be the Mighty God. As he dies on Calvary's cross, he will be the Mighty God. I mean, you think of how the Israelites were trained through centuries of the Old Testament to never say of anything material, this is our God. No golden calf, no image of the divine being. Must never say of that, this is our God. It's breaking the second commandment. And yet here Isaiah is saying, this human being, this baby in a manger, this man with physical limbs, with arms and legs and veins and blood vessels and a digestive system and lungs and clothes on his back, he is our God. What an amazing thing. Again, as we said last week, doesn't it bring that word mystery to mind? It's not mystery in some vague sense that it's all very mysterious, but mystery in the sense it's profound, it's awesome. That the one born as a child is none other than the Mighty God. So this second part of Jesus' name, it's taking us to the very heart of who he is. Who is he? Who is he at every single moment? He's the Mighty God. He didn't have a switch which at the top said God, at the bottom said man, and he kind of switched between the two. No, he never once relinquished and jettisoned his deity. His deity became hidden and veiled beneath layer after layer of weakness and humiliation, until at the cross it seemed almost it was almost impenetrable, the thickness of that layer, the thickness of that veil. But he was still God. Never once not God, still God at every single moment. Jesus' identity comes out. But then also, secondly, Jesus' role. Mighty God. And again, perhaps we're tempted to think of mighty as just a kind of fairly vague adjective, great, mighty, that kind of thing. But the Hebrew word, it has military connotations. And that, of course, fits the passage here, because the passage has had a military theme. You go back to verse 4, where Isaiah says, as in the day of Midian's defeat, you, that is God, have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. So Isaiah here is talking to the Israelites of his day, and he's saying God is going to bring about a great military victory, a great military liberation, and he's going to do it through this child who's going to be born. He's going to be the agent of it, because he's going to be mighty. There's going to be a warrior character about him. And what is this victory then? Well, presumably it's victory over the Assyrians. We said last week, that's the the contemporary problem that Isaiah's facing. The Assyrians were bullying those northern Israelites in Zebulun and Naphtali and Galilee. That's the context. And presumably then this mighty God, he's going to defeat and shatter the Assyrian superpower. That's the victory that's in mind, presumably. Well, it wasn't, was it? Because of course this child wasn't going to be born for another 750 years. By the time he was born, the Assyrians were long gone, no longer in existence. Well, presumably then it was kind of the equivalent of the Assyrians, those 750 years later. The Romans, presumably he was going to come and shatter the Roman power and deliver the Israelites from that oppressive military force. But again, didn't happen, did it? It's what so many expected. It's why so many became disappointed with him. He didn't fulfill their nationalistic aspirations. He even approved of paying taxes to Caesar. What a terrible thing. He didn't shatter the Roman power. What's Isaiah talking about there? What is this victory that he's going to bring about? Who is the oppressor mentioned at the end of verse 4? Whom he's going to shatter? Well, of course, the answer is a far more terrible enemy, a far more terrible oppressor than any Assyrian or Roman superpower. Jesus was going to conquer none other than Satan himself. A promise had been given long before the Assyrians or the Romans ever originated. A promise in the Garden of Eden that the Messiah would crush the head of who? The serpent, Satan. That was the victory for which he came. It was in that context he was going to fulfill the role of mighty God, mighty in crushing Satan. And if we're not thrilled by that tonight, it's because we've bought into the world's lie about who Satan is. That Satan is just this silly cartoon character, this silly, fabulous idea. No, according to the Bible, Satan is a terrible, terrible foe. Satan tyrannizes us in our natural human condition. We're born under the tyranny, under the dictatorship, under the control of Satan. And he seeks then to drag us down with him into the eternal lake of fire. He has the worst possible intentions for us. Satan is the most terrible master. He's dragging us to hell. And it's the most wonderful news in all the world then, that Jesus came to conquer Satan, that he came to crush his head. And that's what he did at Calvary, in the most unlikely circumstances. At the point where he seemed to be defeated himself, he was defeating Satan, disarming Satan, taking away all the glory of Satan's coup in the Garden of Eden so many centuries earlier. It's a wonderful theme, this. Jesus, the mighty God, who destroys our great enemy, Satan. You may have many worries in your life just now, many things that are daunting you and troubling you. But understand this, if you're a Christian, if you belong to King Jesus, then Satan is toothless and powerless. Yes, he can tempt you, he can buffet you, but only as far as your King Jesus lets him. Jesus has him on a chain. Jesus has conquered him. And Satan is powerless to drag you down with him into the lake of fire. That's a wonderful thing. Powerless to lay any charge against you. Powerless to rise up on that last day and say, this man is guilty and must come with me to hell. He can't do that. Jesus has conquered him. It's a wonderful, wonderful theme. But just one other thing before we close. It's good news that Jesus is the mighty conqueror. But we read earlier on of the same person, the same Messiah. He isn't confined to Isaiah 9. He crops up at several points in the different guises in the prophecy of Isaiah. And he crops up again in chapter 63, again as a warrior. But this time, he's not conquering Satan, at Calvary. In Isaiah 63, it's going further than that. It's going beyond that to the last day. And he's conquering the nations. He's conquering rebellious human beings. And it's a grim passage to read. It's solemn. Dreadfully solemn. Talks about his garments being spattered with human blood. It's the picture of this mighty God, this mighty conqueror, on the last day, conquering all those who have remained rebellious and defiant toward him, all those who haven't come to him in repentance and surrender, on that last day, trampling on them, the blood spattering all over him. That's a tremendously solemn thought for us this evening. It's not a laughing matter to be rebelling against Jesus Christ tonight, to be outside of his kingdom, his people. It's not a legitimate lifestyle choice you have made. It's a road to absolute and horrific disaster. It's a road to being those grapes on the last day that King Jesus will trample over. Make sure you're with him. Make sure you've come under his kingship. Make sure you've made peace with him. Make sure you've given your life to him. Make sure he's your king tonight, so that he will never be your enemy on that day. Amen.